From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In 1998, you wrote, "If I had the opportunity to pass but a single law, I would ban every abortion except those medically necessary to save the life of the mother." In 1983, while you were Attorney General, you told the Missouri Citizens for Life annual convention that you would not stop until an amendment outlawing abortion is added to the United States Constitution.
Democrats confront John Ashcroft on abortion, race, and guns. Also, a new federal law mandates forced community service for people in public housing. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Former Senator John Ashcroft and Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee engaged in a series of blistering exchanges on racial issues yesterday, with some legislators accusing Ashcroft of being too racially insensitive to serve the nation's African Americans as Attorney General. Ashcroft defended himself as a foe of discrimination during the second day of his highly charged hearings, and on another key issue of his confirmation battle, pledged not to seek reversal of the Supreme Court decision that granted women the right to an abortion. Despite the heated exchanges, Senator Joseph Biden, Democrat of Delaware, and other Democrats conceded it's likely Ashcroft will be confirmed as the next Attorney General. And at least one Senate Democrat announced he will vote for Ashcroft. But Senator Edward Kennedy said in an interview he has not ruled out a filibuster on the Senate floor in an effort to block Ashcroft's confirmation. It would require 60 votes to cut off debate on the nomination. General Colin Powell, Paul O'Neill, and Christine Todd Whitman also underwent Senate confirmation hearings yesterday. Powell, Bush's Secretary of State nominee, stressed the determination of the Bush administration to press ahead with national missile defense. He also said the sanctions on Iraq need to be strengthened and that the economic embargo against Cuba would be continued. Paul O'Neill, former chair of Alcoa, who Bush nominated for Treasury Secretary, said Congress can expect a tax cut proposal in around 6 weeks. And Christine Todd Whitman, Bush's nominee for director of the Environmental Protection Agency, says she would give states greater latitude in heeding federal pollution control rules. She also said all environmental regulations should be made subject to strict cost-benefit tests and vowed to, quote, move beyond the command and control model of protecting the environment. As governor of New Jersey, Whitman was criticized for relying too heavily on voluntary compliance. Corporate America is lining up to celebrate the new presidency by writing big checks for the Bush inauguration. More than $35 million has been raised in 31 days, mainly in $100,000 donations from leading Republican donors to help finance inauguration festivities. Most of the money has come from corporations with business pressing in Washington, energy companies seeking favorable drilling policies, pharmaceutical companies concerned about a Medicare drug program, sports teams wanting to protect subsidies for sports arenas, and individual companies like American Airlines, America Online, and Microsoft with specific issues before regulators. Blue chip companies like Ford and General Motors and several Washington law and lobbying firms are sponsoring lavish parties for incoming administration officials, some of whom once worked for them. A judge yesterday ruled unconstitutional New Hampshire's school financing plan, a statewide sharing of property taxes, because wealthy communities with higher property valuations were subsidizing poorer ones. Rockingham County Superior Judge Richard Galway said the state constitution requires equal treatment of all taxpayers. Galway ordered the state to return unspecified millions of dollars collected under the law since it was enacted in 1999, although the exact figure was not spelled out in the ruling. Japan is asking the United States to explain how genetically modified corn banned there has again crept into imports from America. This according to a health ministry official. Inspectors this week found samples of Starlink corn, which was developed by North Carolina-based Aventis Crop Science. American exports of corn to Japan, the biggest overseas market for U.S. planters, tumbled after a Japanese consumer group announced that Starlink had been detected in snack foods and animal feed. Officials from the two countries agreed in November to test future shipments for presence of genetically modified varieties. Tokyo this week asked Washington to explain its inspection and handling procedures for clues to how Starlink found its way into the imported corn, but has so far gotten no response. Starlink is approved for animal feed, but not human consumption in the United States. The Justice Department says United Artists Theaters will have to build better seats for disabled people. Disability rights groups call the government's settlement with the theater chain a major victory. The government and several advocacy groups had taken United Artists to court, claiming most wheelchair-bound theatergoers were forced to sit at the front rows of newer stadium-style theaters. That, in turn, forced disabled viewers to crane their heads uncomfortably to see the movie screens. And finally, on the home front, hundreds gathered outside Pacifica Station WBAI last night in another of a series of protests calling for the reinstatement of fired and banned programmers. On the eve of yesterday's protest, a Citibank vice president publicly withdrew his candidacy for the Pacifica National Board after grassroots pressure from activists concerned about the growing corporate presence on the board.
After this manner, therefore, pray. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.
The Lord's Prayer by William S. Burroughs here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to our listeners around the country. And as the in Washington, the Senate is full of confirmation hearings and all the attention, of course, on Ashcroft. But I caught a little bit of the Colin Powell confirmation hearing, and it was amazing to see General Powell discussing with some of the members of the Senate openly the merits of possibly intervening to overthrow Saddam Hussein, as if this was just a question of the proper tactics in American foreign policy, not a question of whether one nation can just openly discuss the overthrow of another political leader.
And Powell talking also about his corporate investments in arms manufacturers. Specifically, he has more than $1 million invested in General Dynamics, the weapons, aviation, and shipbuilding giant. In a letter to the State Department, General Powell said he would divest himself of the stocks if confirmed by the Senate.
And he stands to make, I think, $8 million in stock options when he resigns from the board of AOL as well.
Well, Juan, we're going to continue today with excerpts of the Ashcroft hearing as that hearing continues today, although it looks like at this point, if all of the Republicans support him, and at least one Democrat has said he will, Ashcroft will be the next attorney general. But it was a very hotly contested hearing yesterday by the Senate Judiciary Committee. And among those who questioned him was California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein.
I must tell you, I am deeply puzzled by what I heard yesterday and what I hear today. I'm one that believes that in political life, of which you've been part for 25 years, it's very hard to change your stripes or change your spots. And I see a kind of metamorphosis going on, a mutation, if you will, that somebody that has been really on the far right of many of the issues about which senators have spoken today or yesterday, civil rights, woman's right to choice, certainly guns, is now making a change. And quite frankly, I don't know what to believe. I'd like to confine my questions to choice and to guns. You have a long history of vigorously criticizing the pro-choice position. In 1998, you wrote, "If I had the opportunity to pass but a single law, I would ban every abortion except those medically necessary to save the life of the mother." In 1983, while you were Attorney General, you told the Missouri Citizens for Life annual convention that you would not stop until an amendment outlawing abortion is added to the United States Constitution. When you spoke at the National Right to Life's Committee's annual convention, you said, and I quote, "The Roe decision is simply a miserable failure, and I hope that the Supreme Court announces it is overturning the Roe decision and giving back to the states the right to make public policy." While governor in 1989, you declared the 16th anniversary of Roe v. Wade a day in memoriam for aborted fetuses. So you have, in fact, been an implacable foe of a woman's right to choose for a quarter of a century. You have supported legislation and even a constitutional amendment that would define life at the beginning of fertilization, which would not only criminalize all abortions and take away a woman's right to reproductive freedom and choice, but would also outlaw and criminalize many forms of the most common birth control options. I frankly don't know what to believe. You said of Bill Landlee, and one of the reasons you voted against him was because he had the kind of intensity, and I quote, "that belongs to advocacy, but not with the kind of balance that belongs to administration." And I might respectfully say the same thing about you and your record. I want to ask you some specific questions. We talked in my office about a rape exception, and let me ask this question. Each year, more than 32,000 women become pregnant as a result of rape, and approximately 50% of these end in abortion. Given the circumstances surrounding any rape, and certainly a resulting pregnancy, can you tell us why you feel there is no need for a rape exception to a ban on abortion?
Thank you for your question. I understand these are deeply held views of yours, and my opposition to the aborting of unborn children has been a deeply held position of mine. I have sought in a number of ways through the years to reduce and to curtail the abortion of unborn children, and I understand that reasonable people do differ on these things, and that's been not only my understanding, but it has been a basis for my seeking to act in concert with people to cooperate to move toward a variety of different ways to reduce the level of aborting unborn children in our culture and in our society.
John Ashcroft.
I have voted on numerous occasions for rape and incest exceptions, and have voted for much broader exceptions than that. One time when I was governor, I proposed that we only ban second abortions or abortions for second or third times. We banned abortions for racially mixed children because people were wanting to abort a child for being racially mixed, or we banned abortions for sex selection. So I think it's fair to say that over the course of my time in office and with the prerogatives I've had as a public servant, I have adopted a variety of positions to try and reduce the number of children being aborted. I think it is also fair to say that I know the difference between an enactment role and an enforcement role. And during my time as a public official, I have followed the law, and my following of the law has been clear. When I was the Attorney General of the state, and pro-life groups wanted to insist on the publication of abortion statistics for particular hospitals, and they asked that those abortion statistics be published, I went to the law, and a fair reading of the law didn't allow for the publication of those statistics, which could have made those hospitals the target for pro-life forces. I followed the law in saying that I would not force the state or rule that the state had to publish those statistics when I think the law was clear that it shouldn't. So I have a record of being able to say I know the difference between enacting the law, the debate about the law. My involvement in legislation has, very frankly, in recognition of the law, centered in real terms on trying to do things like get parental consent and other things like that. Those are the kinds of things which I have focused on, the ban on partial birth abortion. But I will enforce the law fairly and aggressively, firmly. I know the difference between the debate over enacting the law and the responsibility of enforcing the law, and that's been clear in my record as a public servant.
Will you maintain the Department of Justice's Task Force on Violence Against Healthcare Providers and give it the resources it needs to continue?
I will. There have been, I think, three different task forces in this respect. I will maintain such task forces and provide them with the kind of resources that they need in order to make sure that we don't impair the constitutional right of women to access reproductive health services.
Will you 100% investigate and prosecute activities that block the entrances to facilities where abortions are performed, even if the conduct is nonviolent?
If the conduct of anyone violates the law regarding the access.
You're listening to a slightly warped tape of John Ashcroft, the Attorney General nominee, being questioned by California Senator Dianne Feinstein on the issue of abortion. We're going to switch now to another issue, another segment of the confirmation hearing yesterday that was held by the Senate Judiciary Committee of John Ashcroft, and it's on the issue of that's being questioned by Senator Edward Kennedy, who ripped into Ashcroft's record on school desegregation on Tuesday, revisiting the topic after Republican Senator John Kyle of Arizona accused Kennedy of misrepresenting Ashcroft's stance. This is Kennedy's response.
The senator has asked about state involvement in the desegregation cases, in the voluntary cases in St. Louis, and he has responded yesterday, and he responded today, and he's wrong. Plain, simple, wrong. Now, this is what the 1980 and the Adams case says. Senator Ashcroft says that the state was not involved in that case. This is what the Adams versus United States, 1980. The city and the state were jointly responsible for maintaining a segregated school system. In reaching this decision, we note that Missouri's state constitution had mandated separate schools for white and colored children through 76, and the state of which he was attorney general had not taken prompt and effective steps to desegregate the city schools and Brown. 1982, the state again protests liability for this. We again note this, that he, the state, and the city board, already a judge violators of the Constitution, could be required to fund the measures. including measures involving a voluntary participation of the schools. The state was involved. The fact is, Senator Ashcroft didn't listen to the judges saying that the state was involved. That's the fact, Senator, and I don't retreat on that. I said it yesterday, and I'll say it again today. And I would hope that he'd have a more complete answer, because it is clear, and any fair-minded person reading those cases will find that to be so. Secondly, I don't retreat in his opposition to failing to meet his responsibilities to register voters in St. Louis. He vetoed one bill, and the senator listed various Democratic officials saying, well, we're glad we vetoed it because it was only targeted on St. Louis. Then the next year, did Senator Ashcroft do anything to try and include registration? No. What happened? The legislature in the state said, if he's going to veto it because it just applies to St. Louis, we'll apply one that goes to the whole state. And what did Senator Ashcroft do, Governor Ashcroft do then? Veto it again. And what's been the bottom line on it? The fact that tens of thousands of blacks were not able to participate in the voting. That happens to be relevant, Senator, because we've just gone through a national debate and discussion and focus on the question of whether minorities are going to be able to vote. And there are current investigations on that issue. That might not be important to you, Senator, but I think it's important to the quality of the person that is going to be the head of the Justice Department. And I don't retreat one step on it. Now the Senator comes back to the questions on guns. On the questions on guns, fine. We talk about the questions, the list on the questions on the guns. Now Senator Ashcroft voted against closing the gun show loophole, said he would have voted to oppose the assault weapons ban. He'll have an opportunity to give this president whether they want to reauthorize the assault weapons ban. I wish he had, in response to earlier question, to show how interested he is in enforcing it, saying, I'd be glad to recommend to the president when it expires, we're going to recommend that he extend that the next time. I'd have given him an opportunity to say that. He's voted twice against child safety locks. He's voted against the ban on the importation of high ammunition magazines, voted twice to weaken existing laws by removing background checks, and he led the campaign for concealable weapons.
Senator Edward Kennedy, during the John Ashcroft confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, John Ashcroft expected still to be confirmed by the full Senate as the Attorney General, though Senator Edward Kennedy says he is considering a filibuster. We'll come back to this line of questioning and then go to the interview that Ashcroft did that was raised in the confirmation hearing with a Southern Partisan magazine, a neo-Confederate magazine. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue with excerpts of the John Ashcroft confirmation hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. John Ashcroft, the designee for Attorney General under George W. Bush. This is Senator Edward Kennedy continuing to talk about the issue of the NRA's support for John Ashcroft and his record on guns.
And he led the campaign for concealable weapons that even child molesters who've been convicted in Missouri would be able to acquire that was defeated by the people of Missouri. And you wonder why we bring up the issue? And, Senator, he used those words that I quoted yesterday. Senator Ashcroft used those words besides calling James Brady, who was shot in the assassination attempt to President Reagan, a loyal Republican, distinguished citizen whose life has been battling those wounds, and you call him the leading enemy of responsible gun owners. And then you went on, I said, as Senator Ashcroft is so far out of the mainstream, he has said, citizens need to be armed in order to protect themselves against a tyrannical government and our government. Our government tyrannical? If the senator from Arizona doesn't know the difference between the British and insurrection at the American Revolution and this government that has been formed under James Madison and the Constitution, there is a significant one. Now listen to this. Listen to what he said is, indeed, and this is a quote, this is Senator Ashcroft, indeed, the Second Amendment, like the first, an important individual liberty that in turn promotes good government. A citizenry armed with the right both to possess firearms and to speak freely is less likely to fall victim to a tyrannical central government than a citizenry that is disarmed from criticizing government or defending themselves. Listen just to what Gary Wells, a Pulitzer Prize, wrote about that. Gary Wells, a Pulitzer Prize, has written, listen, only a madman, one would think, can suppose that militias have a constitutional right to levy war against the United States, which is treason by constitutional definition under this. This, I think this nominee owes an apology to the people of the United States for that insinuation. Talking about our government now being the source of a tyrannical oppression. That's what I think, Senator. I don't retreat. I don't retreat on any one of those matters.
And that was Senator Ted Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts, questioning John Ashcroft on the issue of guns. As we turn now to Senator Biden of Delaware, who continued to question him, this on the issue of race.
There are only two places that black Americans and all minorities have over the last 40 years been able to go with some sense of certainty that their rights would be vindicated and aggressively pursued. One has been the federal courts and some state courts, but primarily the federal courts. The other has been the Justice Department. And I sincerely wish, John, you had been nominated to be Secretary of Defense or Secretary of Commerce or Secretary of State or Secretary of anything but this single job as Attorney General. I will, as not unusual for me, be pilloried by the right and the left for saying this. I find you a man of honesty and integrity. As I said to you, I think you are the classiest person in the last election. The way you bowed out of your race, you did it with class and dignity that was not seen by many Democrat or Republican who were in your position. And I've always had a good relationship with you. I think you would agree to that. But I told you bluntly what my concerns were when we spoke and what they are now. And for those who suggest that maybe this is a bit of an epiphany, I would suggest that it's been the standard I've applied my entire Senate career. And I say to folks, it does matter what you're nominated for. For example, if I had, let me just say it this way. I'm worried, Senator, about the cumulative weight of items that lend the perception, at least, that you are not particularly sympathetic to African Americans' concerns and needs. Not just the Ronnie White case, which is of concern to me, not just the voluntary desegregation order, which was obviously a very contentious issue during your tenure back in Missouri, not merely your appearance at the Bob Jones University, not merely your strong opposition to Bill Land Lee to be the head of the Civil Rights Division, but there seems to be not merely your sponsoring an act called a Civil Rights Act of 97, I guess it was, don't hold me to that, which said that no longer could preferences be given in employment and federal contracts. The cumulative weight is what, quite frankly, concerns me. And I raised with you an interview that you did in a magazine. If this has been raised, please tell me, Mr. Chairman, and I'll read it in the record, in the magazine called the Southern Partisan Magazine. That's a magazine to which you gave an interview, and it's a magazine that has been characterized by the Associated Press and other mainstream publications as a Southern part neo-Confederate publication that regularly vilifies Abraham Lincoln as a tyrant, helps, and so on and so on. I won't go into all the detail. But a magazine that excerpts from the magazine that I've asked my staff to get for me are such as Negroes, Asians, and Orientals, Hispanics, Latins, Eastern Europeans have no temperament for democracy, never have, and probably never will. Or a 1996 article that came with the following claim. Slave owners did not have a practice of breaking up slave families. If anything, they encouraged strong families to further slaves' peace and happiness. Or a 1990 journal article, the same outfit, celebrating former KKK Klansman David Duke as a Confederate candidate concerned about affirmative discrimination, welfare, profligacy, and taxation holocaust, a populist spokesman for a recapturing of the American ideal. Work goes on. After a visit by one of the writers for the Southern Partisan to New York, said, "Where are the Americans? For I met only Italians, Jews, and Puerto Ricans." And the list goes on of these outrageous statements that this magazine had carried. Now, again, by way of context, it may seem by itself unfair to ask you about this, but were I going to be the Secretary of Interior, were I nominated to be the Secretary of Interior, and I had given a long interview or had with the outfit that's called the Earth Liberation Movement, the one that goes and burns down any dwelling that is on a federal land and open space, or were I to give interviews to and say some of the things you said about this magazine to the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, if I were going to be the head of the Department of Agriculture, I think that most Midwestern senators would have a problem. I think most Western senators have a problem if it were regarding the Earth Liberation Movement. Well, I have a problem coming to the Senate getting involved in politics because of civil rights. My state, to its great shame, was segregated by law. We have not been very progressive until the 70s in my state in these issues. And so it bothers me. Now, that's a long background to a relatively short question. You gave an interview to that magazine where you said revisionism, and I think you have a copy of this. Revisionism is a threat to the respect that Americans have for their freedoms and liberty that was at the core of those who founded this country. And when we see George Washington, the founder of our country, called a racist, that is just a total revisionist nonsense, a diatribe against American values. Well, so far, so good. Your magazine also helps set the record straight. You've got a heritage of doing that, of defending Southern patriots like Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, Jefferson Davis. Traditionalists should do more. I've got to do more. We've all got to stand up and speak in this respect, or else we will be taught that these people were giving their lives, subscribing their sacred fortunes and their honor to some perverted agenda. The introduction to that article, they describe you. Day, and you can't be responsible for how you're described, I acknowledge. But in the description of it, it says, John Ashcroft has made a career of public service in Missouri after serving. It goes on and it says that in short time in Washington, the senator has already become known as a champion of states' rights and traditional values. He's also a jealous defender of national sovereignty against the New World Order, and so on and so forth. Now, I have two questions relating to this, Senator. One, actually, three. One, were you aware of the nature of this magazine before you gave the interview? And two, are you now aware, if you weren't then, of the nature of this magazine? And number three, if you are aware now, do you think it was a smart thing to do to give this interview? Not just because I'm asking you the question.
Thank you, Senator. And I appreciate the candor of your remarks. I also appreciate the kind things you said about me. And if someday there's a President Biden, maybe you'll consider defense and commerce and those other things for me.
America's in enough trouble right now.
Let me make something as plain as I can make it. Discrimination is wrong. Slavery was abhorrent. Fundamental to my belief in freedom and liberty is that these are God-given rights. And we have had the stain of slavery in our past. And I recognize that our nation's history is complicated. It's hard for me to know how Thomas Jefferson could write, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and at the same time be a slave owner." And while he owned slaves, I think his articulation of these freedoms planted the seeds that resulted in ultimately doing away with slavery. And so it's complex and complicated. On the magazine, I can't say that I knew very much at all about the magazine. I've given magazine interviews to lots of people. Mother Jones has interviewed me. I don't know if I've ever read the magazine or seen it. Doesn't mean I endorse the views of magazines. A telephone interview. And I regret that speaking to them is being used to imply that I agree with their views.
No, just make it clear, John. I'm not saying that. I know you better.
Okay.
Speaking to them implies to me an incredible insensitivity, number one. Number two, speaking to them, learning who they are, and not condemning them after the fact implies a bit of bullheadedness at the least and a... I don't know what else, but it ain't good. I sincerely mean this. It's a big deal. It's a big deal. You got 20 million black Americans out there that you're going to be representing. They're going to look to you and say, is this guy going to enforce the law? And then they're going to say, wait a minute, this guy finds out that this outfit is this racist neo-Confederate outfit that writes things about Jews and blacks and Eastern Europeans and immigration, and he doesn't condemn them. He doesn't condemn them. I don't quite understand that.
Well, I condemn those things which are condemnable. I mean,
isn't the magazine
slavery
condemnable? I mean, isn't the magazine condemnable? They sell T-shirts that says, you know, the assassin was right.
If they do that, I condemn them. I mean, if they sell T-shirts saying that Abraham Lincoln should have been condemned, I condemn that. Abraham Lincoln is my favorite political figure in the history of this country.
You should tell me, because I'm operating on this. Well, if I'm factually wrong, I'd be happy to hear it.
That's not my purpose. Let me express to you that I believe that racism is wrong. I repudiate it. I repudiate racist organizations. I'm not a member of any of them. I don't subscribe to them. And I reject them. And had I been fighting in the Civil War, I would have fought with Grant. I probably would have, at Appomattox, winced a little bit when Grant let Lee keep his sword and take his horse home with him. But I think that was the right decision. It was a signal at that time by the people on the ground that they recognized that some people who fought on both sides were people of decent will. And it is not time for us to find out who we should be able to hate now that there's a long time gone by. You know why we should respect Grant. You know why we should respect Lee. This Congress has acted to restore the citizenship of Robert E. Lee. And there are a series of members of this panel that voted in favor of restoring the citizenship of Robert E. Lee. And at the time they did so,
They said the entire nation has long recognized the outstanding virtues of courage, patriotism, and selfless devotion to the duty of General Robert E. Lee.
John, you're good, but this ain't about Robert E. Lee. I just hope when you're Attorney General, you will understand you got to reach out. I've gone too much.
Did you have further?
And that was former Senator John Ashcroft being questioned by Delaware Democratic Senator Joseph Biden during the confirmation hearings for Attorney General of John Ashcroft by the Senate Judiciary Committee. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to take a look at a new federal law that few have noticed that mandates forced community service for people living in public housing. Be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. And as we said earlier, it's not just John Ashcroft who is being nominated and confirmed in the Senate hearings this week. Gail Norton, Secretary of the Interior, her hearings today, yesterday. Paul O'Neill as Treasury Secretary. And Mel Martinez being confirmed or having confirmation hearings, the Housing Urban Development Secretary. His nomination is up. A little known Florida official for Secretary of Housing and Urban Development sailing through the Senate. He's an ally of Bush's brother, Florida Governor Jeb Bush, and co-chair of George W. Bush's presidential campaign in Florida. The Cuban American was named to head the Federal Housing Agency after serving 2 years as chair of the government of Orange County, Florida. As chair of the Orlando Housing Authority, he handled the housing situation in Orlando, which has one of the tightest markets for affordable housing in the nation. Although Martinez promised to address issues of low-income housing, one issue is already rallying people across the country. People living in public housing are facing the implementation of a 1998 federal public housing law, the Quality Housing Act, that requires them to put in 8 hours each month for, quote, voluntary community service, or they face eviction. The law applies to hundreds of thousands of public housing tenants around the country, yet it's gotten almost no media attention, and most tenants are not aware of it themselves. Opponents see the work requirement as a version of welfare reform, only worse. Public housing tenants, they note, unlike welfare recipients, already pay rent to the government for their apartments, and many, except for the poorest ones, also pay taxes. We are going to take a look at this law right now that's just gone into effect. Juan, you did a column in the New York Daily News this week on the issue.
Yes, and the full name of the law is the Quality Housing and Work Responsibility Act, and it was initiated by Long Island Congressman Rick Lazio, the Republican who ran against Hillary Clinton for the New York Senate seat and lost. But it was passed overwhelmingly in 1998 by a 409-14 vote, and President Clinton signed it without making much of a fuss. So both Democrats and Republicans participated in this bill. We're going to talk to at least one person who is dealing with it, a tenant president at the Johnson Houses in East Harlem, Ethel Velez, who's with us by phone, and then some other people who have been advocates who have been fighting against the bill. I'd like to first introduce Ethel Velez. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you heard about the bill and what you've been doing and why you think it's so unfair to people in public housing?
Yes. I heard about the bill probably about a year or so ago, and the group that we belong to, the New York City Public Housing Resident Alliance, we're a group that was formed of tenant residents who were concerned about all of the new policies that are being put in place for folks who live in public housing. We think that this bill is devastating because, like the welfare reform, it is forcing people who are financially challenged to have more things put upon them other than giving people jobs and adequate places to live. The feeling of people is saying, if we're paying our rent, why would we need to also do community service? Like the article that was written in the papers about how Rick Lazio feels that he's doing something for us to make us feel worthy almost of even accepting public funds, which is an illusion that we receive so much more money than other corporations or other folks who live in other type of housing that receive HUD monies.
Well, clearly there are all kinds of federal subsidies meted out, not only in the housing area, but in other branches of American society. But this, to my knowledge, is the first time that people are being required to actually work for no pay for those subsidies. I'd like to bring in Vic Bach, who's a senior housing policy analyst at the Community Service Society. Could you tell us when did this this act take effect, and what is the implementation going to be like as far as you understand?
Well, the act was actually passed in late 1998, but this provision of the law, the community service requirement, is due to be implemented January 2001. In New York City, the Housing Authority tells us it will begin implementation as of about March. So it has not yet directly affected residents, although the Housing Authority projects that 70 to 80,000 residents will be subject to the requirement and their households at risk of eviction if they don't comply.
And this is going to be true around the country?
It will be true around the country, and if we just sort of extrapolate from New York City figures, there'll be at least 500,000, half million or more residents across the country who will be required to put in 8 hours a month of unpaid service.
Doing what?
The legislation broadly calls it community service. It's up to each housing authority to specify what forms of service are eligible to be counted toward the 8 hour a month requirement. The New York Authority has been fairly open-ended about the various forms of service that are acceptable.
Well, we're also joined by Othello Poulard, a senior officer for the Center for Community Change. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now! Mr. Poulard, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
I'd like to ask you, this has gotten almost no publicity, this particular requirement of this housing bill. Could you tell us how this developed and why so little notice publicly around the country about this?
First, quickly and briefly, how it came to be, how it managed to become included as a core component in the recently enacted comprehensive bill. The enactment and the content of the bill really is merely illustrative of what is fundamentally flawed in how our federal policymakers, who are for the most part mainstream individuals in their thinking and their level of income, in their priority setting, it's illustrative of how it is that in setting policy, they're very, very comfortable in making decisions and appropriating resources that benefit folk who already have most of what they need, and very, very punitive in addressing folk who most need help, in this case, housing. For example, in America, the federal government, through its policies, forgoes collecting between $99 and $102 billion every year by letting big shots, mainstream America, middle-income America, deduct from their income taxes all every penny they spend on the interest on mortgages and on real estate taxes. That's a lot of help for homeowners who need help less. They are not obligated to provide community services to get that support. Conversely, HUD spends no more than $2.9 billion on operating subsidies for public housing, $3 billion annually for capital investment, and for that small appropriation of housing assistance for poor people, these mainstream policymakers feel comfortable putting the string of required community services. Now, you don't have time to listen to the plethora of other policies around other issue areas where this same fundamental approach in governance is also seen. But you ask how it happened that this occurred. People like Mr. Lazio and his kind, who think like they think, always do this. This time it happens to be public housing.
And in terms of the implementation, it's my understanding that because obviously to implement something like this, they're going to have to set up a whole other bureaucracy just to keep track of the 8 hours a month that people give it that
no,
are supposed
won't.
To give
no,
in.
The housing authorities at the local level who will be overseeing this are well heeled at keeping their thumbs on residents, and they are accustomed. The 3,400 of them that will be implementing this, they are accustomed to performing more like wardens than creative support systems, so they can almost overnight find ways to use their basic infrastructure to make residents go to work or be evicted.
Well, Ethel Velez, what about that? What about this whole issue of how they attempt to act like wardens or, as you told me when I interviewed you, talking about how they're attempting to criminalize public housing residents? I understand, for instance, that now a lot of the housing authority in New York is requiring people when they sign new leases to have photos taken so that the photos have to accompany their leases, something that no one else who has to sign a lease anywhere has to do.
Well, yes, that is something that it has not been really brought to the residents yet. It is being put in place. So as it's being put in place, people are like running very scared, wondering what is all of this going to come to. We are very concerned about how this whole program is going to be monitored. We don't have an idea. We don't know how it's going to happen. But the authority does have their way of holding people accountable, and sometimes not always to the residents' advantage. It seems to be that there is privatization is something that folks are talking about, and it seems to be every program that the authority is coming up with, or HUD, or whoever is coming up with these new rules, it leads to eviction. It's almost like 12 steps of eviction is going on. Anything, any new bill that has been signed, it comes to eviction. Rather, it's the Hope 6 project, you know, the one strike and you're out. There's all of these new things that are being played on public housing. And at the same time, there's all of these funds that are coming in that's supposed to uplift folks in public housing. And it just seems to be a very bad contradictory of what's going on, you know, right now with folks who need housing.
Ethel Velez, you're the Tenant Association president at Johnson Housing in East Harlem in
yes.
New York. Would your presidency as the head of the Tenant Association count as your community service?
Yes, it will. One of the things that is really I guess, nice on one end is that they say TA presidents do a lot of work, so they would be exempt from this. But there, I think even the authorities are even looking for help on how they can do this. You know, they're trying to include as many things as possible to exempt people or even to minimize what would be counted as community service.
Othello Pillard, is it possible, you're with the Center for Community Change in Washington, that people's involvement in groups like, say, those who are coming down to protest the inauguration could count, that this new law will promote protest and advocacy around the very issues that...
Oh, the inaugural demonstrations will not be attracting, I suspect, a lot of public housing residents, no advocates. The alarm will be on other matters. But residents themselves, really, residents themselves must increasingly turn to themselves and partners whom they specifically find to help them to address this and other threatening measures. And that is the reason why, beginning a few years ago, the Center for Community Change began appropriating a substantial amount of its resources to not itself run public housing assistance program, but to instead help residents to build their own national public housing resident-led organization, so that in time there is the hope that residents, by virtue of their number, staying power, focus, and the like, will be able, like other interest groups that are also well-organized, able to get into the face of policymakers, not arrogantly, but with determination, and win for themselves the kinds of moral and practical concessions do them, so that bad measures like these will stop. Residents themselves, with their partners, led by residents, really are the only answer, I suspect, to get policymakers to do right by them.
Well, I'd like to ask Vic Bach. This new law and most of federal policy lately seems to be geared increasingly toward getting the federal government out of bricks and mortar public housing, and there seems to be more and more of a shift into what they call, for the poor, Section 8 certificates, where people individually go out into the private market and get their own housing with a government subsidy, but that can often be just taken away as well. Could you talk about a little bit about that, how the government is moving out of housing for the poor?
Well, it's certainly withdrawing from housing for the poor and from the programs that have built up since the 1930s. In terms of funding commitments, Washington has been in withdrawal. But apart from this community service requirement, which, like other provisions, makes it more difficult and oppressive for low-income people to get what they need, there are other provisions of the law that are pulling back on public housing. For instance, the Quality Housing Act says that housing authorities can't build any more public housing. They can't add more public housing to their stock. They can form partnerships with private enterprise and build housing that's available for a temporary period of time, but we still have to talk about the national commitment to public housing.
Well, I want to thank you, Vic Bach, Senior Housing Policy Analyst at Community Service Society in New York, Othello Pillard, Senior Officer at Center for Community Change in Washington, and Ethel Velez, Tenant Association President in Johnson Housing in East Harlem, New York, for enlightening us on this law that's going into effect that not a lot of people know about, but at least 500,000 will be affected by in the coming months. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230, and you can write to us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Our engineer is Anthony Sloan. Special thanks to Robert Knight, Technical Director Errol Maitland. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Fired and the Band, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.
Oh, it was a sad state of affairs. This is WBAI.